This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, the 20th anniversary of the meltdown at Three Mile Island, America's worst nuclear disaster. What has changed, and could it happen again? While most people run away from tornadoes, one professor is teaching his students to chase them. We dodge penguins and seals as we skim the waters off the Antarctic coastline in an open boat in search of an ice cave. And on the Earth calendar, prairie chickens are nesting in Texas. There are only 56 left in the wild. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. 20 years ago, on March 28, 1979, an accident in Unit 2 of the Three Mile Island, or TMI, nuclear generating plant caused a release of radioactive material in the surrounding community near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It's known as the worst nuclear accident in American history. On the 20th anniversary of the event, we look at what has changed and whether it could happen again. David Lockbaum is a nuclear safety engineer for the nonprofit group Union of Concerned Scientists. He described what happened.
Well, basically, the accident started out as a minor disturbance on the non-nuclear portion of the plant. A system experienced a problem that had happened at about 11 or 12 times at that same plant in the previous year. This fairly routine incident was complicated by equipment failures that caused the plant to automatically shut down and the removal of heat from the reactor to be interrupted. Emergency systems responded to that situation and automatically turned on and started to handle that situation, but some additional equipment failures misled the operators into thinking they had too much water when in fact they had too little water. And based on that false indication, they shut off the emergency systems. And as a result of that action, the water level in the reactor core dropped down too low and the fuel actually melted.
Lockbaum, who used to work for the nuclear industry, thinks some positive things came out of the catastrophe.
We learned a lot of things. I think the three areas that we would point to where perhaps most of the knowledge was gained was in the area of emergency planning, both on-site and off-site, operator training was greatly improved as a result of the accident. And the third area was there was an industry watchdog group, the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations, or IMPO, was created shortly after the accident because each nuclear plant owner knew that they were basically all in the same boat, and not only one end of the boat sinks, they all go down. So they couldn't have another repeat of that accident without affecting all of them.
Frank Congell, who is Director of Incident Response Operations for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, says since TMI, changes have been made in the controls and hardware of plants, as well as emergency procedures.
I think substantial improvement in both regulatory practices as well as the industry performance resulted from that unfortunate accident. And it not only was with the plants directly, but even the preparation for a situation where an actual accident did occur again. There are procedures in place now where a substantial amount of capability could be brought to assist state and locals in responding to any accident at a plant. This was something that simply did not exist with any depth 20 years ago.
Analysis of the TMI incident emphasized the need for better training of plant operators. Angie Howard, Senior Vice President for Industry Communications of the Nuclear Energy Institute, which represents nuclear power producers, says the industry has responded.
The approach to training has been changed to address the symptoms of what has occurred. It's very similar to a triage type of thing in a hospital emergency room. Not try to figure out what exactly is wrong, but let's stop the bleeding and stabilize the patient. They also today are trained on full-scale simulators where the operators not only have extensive classroom and theory work, but then they practice that in full-scale plant simulators where they can practice handling off-normal events.
Lockbaum from the Union of Concerned Scientists says his studies reveal that progress has been made in training plant operators, but he thinks it is still not good enough.
We did a study of 10 plants in the last year. In one of those plants, the River Bend plant in Louisiana reported that 68% of its safety problems were caused or involved worker mistakes, and that's just simply too high. That's way too high by anybody's measure.
While both the NRC and industry spokespeople are confident that major problems presented by TMI have now been corrected, Eric Epstein, a citizen activist who lives in the community, is not so sure. He is chairman of 3 Mile Alert and coordinator of the Citizens Monitoring Group that keeps track of radiation levels in the area. TMI-2 has been shut down, but he is concerned about what is going to happen to it, and more specifically, what is not going to happen.
The plant needs to be taken apart and buried or isolated somewhere, and that's one of the riddles of nuclear power that has yet to been solved. There has not been a commercial nuclear power plant decommissioned in the country. The largest to date has been 52 megawatts at Shippingport in western Pennsylvania, and TMI-2 is approximately 850 megawatts. And at this particular point, unless there are some drastic changes made in funding and research, that plant may be entombed. Right now what we're dealing with is a high-level and low-level radioactive waste site on an island in the middle of a river that empties into the Chesapeake Bay.
For Epstein, the passage of 20 years has not ended the incident.
I just don't see the company garnering the resources and putting together the technology necessary to clean the plant up, and that's a scary thought for us. I think we deserve better. Essentially, as a community, it's an accident without an end. There is no closure, and right now there's no closure in sight. So it's a trauma that didn't necessarily begin in March and end in April of 79. It's an ongoing trauma that has yet to see any sense of closure for our community.
And so, 20 years after TMI, there have been substantial changes in the operation and regulation of nuclear power plants in the United States. Whether they're adequate may be a function of whether you see the glass as half full or half empty. Picture yourself chasing a tornado in the name of science. It sounds a little crazy, but in the Midwest, there are groups that do just that. They're called storm chasers, researchers who literally chase severe thunderstorms that have the potential of becoming tornadoes. You may have seen the movie Twister, which gives Hollywood's version of the dramatic and dangerous work performed by these scientists. For years, scientists at federal facilities and universities in the Midwest have been collecting data on tornadoes in an effort to better understand these destructive storms. Now, a new team has been formed in Missouri that may help future climate forecasters. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has the story.
Most of the tornadoes in the United States occur in what's called Tornado Alley, which runs from Nebraska southward through central Texas. But just east of this beltway is the state of Missouri, which sees its fair share of severe thunderstorms and tornadoes every year. Spring officially begins the tornado season, and this year some students at the University of Missouri will be on the lookout. Jason Brands is a senior in the Soil and Atmospheric Science Department.
Well, to be quite honest, it's been really exciting so far. We started this chase team back in April of 1997, and we had minimal success at first, but last April, which would have been April of 98, we had some really successful chases where we saw the severe thunderstorms that we were after.
Some 15 students in the Soil and Atmospheric Science Department have joined the team of storm chasers led by Professor Anthony Lupo. This is the third year students will be chasing tornadoes with the use of maps and automobiles. Last year, the team witnessed 7 storms, and even though members have yet to see a tornado firsthand, Professor Lupo says on two occasions, the team arrived just after tornadoes touched down.
And in one instance last year, the students were able to call in the local law enforcement officials and say, hey, yes, there was a tornado here. It was moving in the northeast direction, and presumably that information would be relayed to the Weather Service, which helps them as they can warn communities downstream of the event.
While most tornadoes contain winds of less than 110 miles per hour, 2% can possess winds greater than 205. 2% doesn't seem like much, but it accounts for 70% of all tornado-related deaths. The dangers involved in storm chasing can make it an exciting experience for undergraduates. But Professor Lupo stresses that the focus of the team is on learning. He says by tracking storm development, students are able to witness life cycles firsthand.
And then to think about that storm and whether what they're seeing looks like what they're taught in the classroom. So it's essentially an outside, or almost like an outdoor laboratory, because the students get to apply what they've learned in the classroom and see how that works in nature.
A lot has changed over the years in the fields of atmospheric science and meteorology. Satellites, radar, and other forms of monitoring equipment allow scientists to see when and where conditions are right for severe thunderstorms and tornadoes. Most of us have seen the devastation tornadoes can have on communities, which makes our ability to predict such storms even more critical. This ability to warn people ahead of time can literally mean the difference between life and death. Student Jason Brands says he is dedicated to the cause and believes this experience will help him in the future.
Well, after I graduate, I plan on going to grad school. What I'd like to do eventually is study tornadoes and supercell thunderstorms. I'd like to do research on those two. A goal of mine would be to work for NOAA or National Severe Storms Laboratory or something to that effect.
While storm chasing seems like exciting work, it is very dangerous. Professor Lupo says he takes every precaution to make sure his students are safe.
Storm chasing is not a recreational sport, and it's something that's done with a lot of careful planning and thought. And when they go out and do the actual chasing, it's done with a careful plan. They have a line of communication with home, and they certainly obey all the rules of the road and observe common courtesy.
While the spring and summer months are peak season, tornadoes can occur any time of year and in any state in the country. Experts say if a tornado warning is forecast for your area, hide in a basement or shelter. If you do not have a basement, hide beneath a sturdy piece of furniture. The best line of defense against tornadoes is to listen for warnings issued by the Weather Service and have a plan in mind. But if you don't hear of a tornado warning and happen to be in Columbia, Missouri, take cover if you see Professor Lupo and his students rushing from the university campus on a stormy day. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Yeah, you know the wind was blowing, coming in my winter door. Yeah, you know the wind was blowing, coming in my winter door. Yeah, you know my house done fell down, and I can't live there no more. I say, Lord, Lord, what shall we do?
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. We're interested in environmental issues that may affect you. Give us a call. The number is 1-888- 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. You can write us at Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author and journalist David Helbarg, it's Antarctica, where scavengers slap you on the back of the head and seals blissfully scratch themselves. In this portrait of place, Helbarg reads an essay about a recent 6-week stay on the southernmost continent. It's titled, A Day on the Water.
At Palmer Station, Antarctica, you have to have at least 2 people and radios in order to take out one of the Zodiacs. And by my 2nd week there, I was seriously addicted to these fast, maneuverable black rubber boats. So we're not off with the researchers reporting on climate change, ozone depletion, or how to make a penguin puke for science. I'd spend my time looking for a boating partner. Doc, the station physician, who used to work the ER in Kodiak, Alaska, was always up for an adventure. So here we were, cruising past the overturned hull of the Bahia Palacio, an Argentine Navy supply ship that sank near Palmer in 89, creating Antarctica's only major oil spill. I then took the Zodiac up on platform, heading towards Loudwater Cove on the other side of Norsel Point. The following seas provided me a chance to surf the 15-foot craft past the rocky spires of Litchfield Island and around the big waves at Norsel. We then motored round a few apartment-sized blue and white icebergs, crossing over to the glacier face to look at Fern Ice Cave. But when we got caught up on the rocks and had to use our oars to free ourselves, we decided to back off, the chance of the glacier calving a wall of ice down on top of us being too great. I steered us over to a rocky landing on the opposite shore, where we tied off our bow line, watching a serpentine leopard seal sleeping on an adjacent ice floe for a while. We then dumped our float coats and climbed up and over some rocky granite scree and down a snowfield splotched with red algae to the opening of another ice cave at Old Palmer, the abandoned British station. Down in the cave, it was like a dripping blue tunnel with slush over a clear ice floor showing down to the rocky Piedmont. Hard blue glacier ice also formed the bumpy roof with its stalactite-like icicles and delicate ice rills forming along the sides of the cave. There was also a faint zoo smell from elephant seals having waddled around in there. Outside, we hiked the loose granite feldspar and glacial sand toward the old station's remnant foundations, where we encountered a fur seal hauled up several hundred yards from the water's edge on the sharp broken rocks. He barked and whined a warning at us before paddle-walking back towards the water. The nearby ponds and hundred-year-old moss beds had also attracted brown skuas, who were nesting colony-thick, and soon began dive-bombing us. I waved most of them away, but got whacked from behind by one of the 5-pound scavengers. It felt like getting slapped hard on the back of the head by a good-sized man. We quickly moved away from their nests, climbing back over the exposed glacier rock, past midgets of limpet shells, and down a steep rock chimney to where our boat was tied up. The leopard seal was awake now, checking us out as we took off. We next dropped by Christine, a big bouldery island with more belligerent skuas. We walked past a flats where a big congregation of elephant seals was hanging out on a beach, opposite a squawking colony of Adelie penguins on guano-stained bluffs the color of red Georgia clay. Crossing the heights, we found mossy green swales with ponds full of brine shrimp. We then lay out on a rocky beach at the end of a narrow blue channel. We spent about an hour there sharing the space with 2 elephant seals, about 500 and 800 pounds. The southern ocean water was crystal clear. The sun came out and the sky turned cobalt blue, and it felt kind of tropical, lounging to the sound of the waves rolling across smooth stones. Further out were several flat islands with big breakers crashing over them, amidst a congregation of brash ice and bar ice. The east seals were blowing and blinking their huge red eyes, their pupils the size of teaspoons, for gathering light in deep diving forays after squid. A fur seal who had left at our approach now returned, corkscrewing through the channel's water before paddle walking ashore and scratching himself with a hind flipper, a blissful expression on his wolfy face. And so there we were, just five lazy mammals enjoying a bit of sun. Driving the Zodiac back to station, we were accompanied by a flight of blue-eyed shags and squads of porpoising penguins in the water. The sky was clouding over again, the water the color of hammered tin, and with the icy cold salt water spray in our faces, all sure seemed right with the world.
That was author and journalist David Helbarg reading A Day on the Water, an essay he wrote about a recent visit to Antarctica. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As you listen to this program, prairie chickens are nesting in Texas. One population can be found at Galveston Bay Prairie Preserve near Texas City. The preserve is operated by the Nature Conservancy. Manager Matt Williams says prairie chicken hens normally lay between 10 and 14 eggs.
The birds nest typically in coastal tallgrass prairies. For the nesting season, they prefer prairie grasses that are a little bit more dense. When they're feeding, they would go into areas that have, you know, fairly good cover, but would also have some openings in the structure of the grasses where they could be able to maneuver.
The chicks hatch in April and stay together through the summer months. They won't begin venturing out on their own until fall. Matt says rainfall is important to the survival of chicks. Low precipitation levels can mean few insects, which prairie chickens feed on. The birds will also eat small green leaves and some seeds. The mating process began in January, when the males dance and perform other elaborate courting behaviors.
All the males come together on what's called a lek, and it's typically an area of shorter grass, and the males will come up and display, and they will puff up some orange-colored air sacs that are on the sides of their neck, and that air is then forced through, and it creates a booming sound. And it sounds quite a bit like the sound that you can make by blowing across the top of a pop bottle. It's kind of an eerie sound in a way if you're out there early in the morning, especially if there's a little bit of fog.
Prairie chickens are similar in appearance to grouse, standing about 17 inches tall. Matt Williams describes them as stocky and strong flyers.
They have a strong barring pattern across the breast. It's kind of a brown and white pattern, and it's amazing how well those birds can blend into the grasses. They typically like to run from predators instead of flying. They have extremely good camouflage.
At one time, prairie chickens numbered in the millions in the United States. But agricultural development and urban sprawl have slowly destroyed their habitat. Prairie chickens were listed as an endangered species in 1967, and today only 56 remain in the wild. 36 can be found at the Galveston Bay Prairie Preserve. Captive breeding programs are attempting to keep prairie chickens from becoming extinct. However, the birds only live an average of 2 to 3 years, and mortality rates are high. Besides encroachment by humans, predation by great horned owls and coyotes decrease adult populations. Frequently, they don't even make it to maturity because raccoons, skunks, and fire ants raid nests and consume the eggs. Apparently, owls, coyotes, raccoons, skunks, and fire ants don't know much about the Federal Endangered Species Act. If they did, the prospect of prosecution would undoubtedly quell their appetite for prairie chicken. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, are you in the market for a new vehicle? The Green Guide to Cars and Trucks tells you how green each of the 1999 models are and which are an absolute insult to Mother Earth. We talk green about environmental journalism. Is the press telling us what we need to know about the health of the planet and what is affecting it? We update some issues you heard about on this program, and we hear from listeners about humane slaughter, population and immigration, and the urban environment. Stay with us. Spring is here, and for many folks, it's time to trade in the winter rat and buy a new car. Auto dealers traditionally sell a lot of vehicles at this time of year and will be offering all sorts of promotions to capitalize on our passion for snazzy transportation, which is renewed each spring. But before you drive off the lot in that shiny new machine, consider how your purchase will affect the environment. Stephen Westcott reports on a new book that can help.
The American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy has just released its Green Guide to Cars and Trucks for 1999. ACEEE is a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C., that is funded by both the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Energy. The guide ranks new vehicles on their environmental impacts.
We rate every vehicle on the market. We give it an overall green rating. So we try to encompass as much information as we can. So that includes fuel economy and tailpipe emissions, which cause smog and local air pollution problems, as well as emissions that take place during the manufacturing of vehicles.
That's Martin Thomas, research assistant at the Council and co-author of the Green Guide to Cars and Trucks. He says the amount of recycled materials used to produce 1999 models was not included in the guide because not all manufacturers have that information. This makes across-the-board comparisons impossible. Thomas says the book distinguishes between vehicles that meet federal emission standards and those meeting California's tougher standards. But even though a buyer lives in Texas, Florida, or New York State, Thomas says he or she can often purchase a vehicle with a California emission system.
You might get a strange look at first when you ask a dealer, is this a California-certified car? But I know from experience it is something they can find out, and I think that's great if people go in there and the dealers are finding out, hey, people care about how clean this car is. It's going to have an impact on the auto manufacturers. Now, in some places, there's a label which will tell you which emission standard, whether it's a California standard or the federal standard, a vehicle meets. But that's not uniform nationwide.
The guide also distinguishes between automatic and manual transmission vehicles, and almost every car on the market can be found in the Green Guide. The rankings are determined by a car's performance relative to others in its class. So what are the highest-rated vehicles in the Green Guide? Martin Thomas says there is a list of 12 that includes some electric cars, cars that are not very practical and have yet to reach the mainstream market. But there is another list as well.
So we also have a table that we call Practical Picks. And on this table, we highlight some of the best gasoline-powered vehicles and automatic transmission vehicles that are sort of middle of the market. Some of those vehicles include the Honda Civic, Mazda Protege, Saturn SW Wagon, and then we also identify them in the light truck category, such as the Dodge Caravan with a four-cylinder engine, the Ford Ranger with a four-cylinder engine, and Mitsubishi Montero.
The guide also lists what it determines to be the 12 worst vehicles for the environment in 1999. Sharing the number three spot are the Chevy Tahoe and GMC Yukon. Second are the Chevy Silverado and GMC Sierra. And the worst vehicle for the environment award goes to the Cadillac Escalade. Overall, Martin says the purpose of the book is to simply help consumers consider the environmental effects of their purchases.
Lots of decisions go into buying a car. How many people you need to haul around, safety, fuel economy, many factors. So I don't want to say, yes, you should buy this car, no, you shouldn't buy that car. That's not really the point of our book. What we like to point out is that there are greener choices in every segment of the auto market. So if you're in the market for a station wagon, we point out, and we arrange the guide this way, which are the cleanest station wagons, which are the not-so-clean station wagons. And we do that also for pickups, sport utilities, compact cars, all the way through the line.
Generally speaking, Thomas says, while automakers have made progress in manufacturing vehicles that are better for the environment, there are areas where improvements are needed. He says tailpipe emissions are cleaner than they were, but adds that fuel economy has declined in many models. I contacted a salesman at a local Chevrolet dealer to inquire whether customers ask about the environmental impacts of vehicles. He says a lot of consumers ask about gas mileage, but few request information about tailpipe emissions. If this is true, a lot of Americans need to be better educated about the environmental effects of their vehicles, and perhaps the Green Guide to Cars and Trucks for 1999 can help. For information on the book, contact the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy by email at aceee.org or simply go to amazon.com. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Most of us learn about what is happening to the environment from newspapers, radio, magazines, and television, and most environmental reporters will tell you that their editors will not give them enough time or space to do the comprehensive job they think is important to educate a public that wants and needs to know more about the planet and how we're treating it. So today, let's look at environmental journalism. Are the right issues being covered? How's the media doing? And is it doing the right thing? And my guests are a couple of perhaps the most experienced and knowledgeable people in the country to discuss this issue. They're Peter Dykstra. He is executive producer of Science, Technology, and Environment with CNN, the cable news network, and he is at CNN headquarters in Atlanta. Also with us is Jim Detchen, and he was formerly a reporter and editor. Now he is director at the Knight Center of Environmental Journalism at the Michigan State University. So welcome to you both. Peter, let's start with you as a television guru, magnate, producer, and so on. Is the public getting enough information about the decisions it needs to make with respect to the environment, either as a voter or as a consumer, through television?
The one-word answer is no. It's a very, very difficult situation in the current framework of how TV decisions are made. The environment doesn't fit TV's framework because it's rarely the single most important story. We tend to get transfixed to it, whether it's impeachment or O.J. Simpson or Iraq. We tend to get transfixed with that one lone big story. And a story like our relationship with the environment, even though it will be a big story every day for the rest of our lives, isn't judged to make the grade. And, of course, that can be a very, very frustrating scenario for somebody in the position of hoping to get very important stories covered.
Well, let's look at this in contrast to, say, the print medium. Jim Detchen from Michigan State University, how do you think the print fellows do when it comes to providing the information that really an informed public ought to have to be able to cope with environmental issues?
Peter, I think the print is doing a better job than it did 20, 25 years ago. I think it's still not doing anywhere near the job it should do. And some of the same constraints you're seeing on television occur in print. Journalists have only a relatively small space to tell complicated stories, and they're under constant deadline pressure to write stories almost every day, so it's difficult for them to put them into a larger context and to talk about sort of the nuances of some of these stories.
What I think I hear you both saying is that neither one of these media, as they are now organized, are really set up to be able to do much better. Am I right about that?
Well, Peter, I would argue that I think they can do better even the way they are organized. And, for example, I have pushed very vigorously for the establishment of science or environmental pages or sections in newspapers. And a good number of papers, including the Philadelphia Inquirer, where I used to work, have established these papers. And when you have these sections, you have more space, you have more time to explain a story, and you also don't have to have the conflict. Often news is news only because there's a conflict going on. And a lot of environmental stories, they're trend stories, and you really are distorting things if you make them into a conflict. Sometimes it's better just to explain an interesting story.
Now, Peter, on CNN, yours is the only network, I believe, that has a scheduled programmed half hour on the environment. That clearly, I would presume, is not enough, but is there any way around this issue?
It's a difficult situation. Of course, we have a very unique situation at CNN. It's something we make no bones about, the fact that the guy who started the place, Ted Turner, has himself put a high priority on these issues. 20 years ago, he was saying the environment's going to be big and that cable TV is going to be big, and he's certainly been proven right on one, and I think we're in the process of proving him right on how huge a political issue the environment would be. It's one that tends to fly under the radar screen, I think partly because a lot of editors don't understand it and they're not comfortable with their own understanding. They're not willing to take chances on stories. The good side is that we see environment integrating itself as a part of the decision-making process virtually everywhere, in political stories, in business stories. 20 years ago, you did not see any reference to environmental concerns, let's say, on the business page of a newspaper and a business TV show. At least there, now it's there. It's on the map. It may not be to the prominence of the liking of many of us. We may not get to discuss the problems more on TV than a minute 45 news story. But at least it's there, and I do see that improving, even though the indifference is a little frustrating sometimes.
Well, this complaint about editors is one you hear at every conference in environmental journalism. And Jim Dechen, I thought I saw a study that came out of your school that basically said the public was more interested in these kind of issues than the editors were. Editors were chopping down on space allocated for the environment, while the polls and so on were showing people wanted more of it. What's going on here?
You're right about what polls have shown. There have been any number of surveys, one that was done by Roper about a year ago, which showed that environment, in terms of the stories the public wants, environment maybe ranked third out of maybe a list of 25. And numerous polls that have been done in Detroit, Philadelphia, California, and around the country have shown great public interest in environmental topics, and you're right. One of the battles that environmental journalists face is trying to convince their editors that these are in fact important stories.
Now, but what is wrong with the editors?
Well,
they presumably have some rationale for what they're doing.
Well, one of the things is that first of all, many editors in the news media don't have a background. They've worked their ways up through a newsroom with backgrounds in covering politics and covering police news and covering the more traditional side types of news. So they're less comfortable writing about environmental stories, which are complicated science stories, and they're just more difficult to cover. But there's some other reasons, too. Sometimes environmental stories offend advertisers and business interests who are, in fact, the people that support by buying commercials and advertisements, news media. That's another factor. And also, sometimes these stories result in lawsuits, and that costs newspapers and editors money to defend them. So there's a variety of reasons, but I think the biggest thing is that editors don't have the background. They're not comfortable with these stories.
Now,
Peter Dykstra, CNN is a little different, again, because of the influence of Ted Turner, who is one of the country's great environmentalists, and yet there's just not a lot of environmental coverage, if one thinks about it, that you get half an hour a week. What's going on there?
It's a framework that just doesn't fit. As Jim Detchen just said, I think there's probably an element of this that doesn't appeal to advertisers, either because the people who might be likely to advertise on an environmental show probably want to advertise because their environmental image needs a little improvement. Timber companies, oil companies, folks that have been involved in controversy. That creates a business dynamic that maybe in silent ways discourages more coverage elsewhere on other networks. Also, there's a very simple equation. We're told to keep news stories on average to about a minute and 45 seconds, and it is an unenviable task to try and explain something like climate change or endocrine disrupting chemicals. Essentially, what we need to do is explain a dedicated scientist's life's work and all of its implications on a complicated environmental issue in a sentence.
I understand that.
Let me
make a pitch for the Environment Show. We are permitted, or our market tells us that we can go up to 6.5 minutes on a story, but that's a long story, but that's something you can do on radio that you can't do anywhere else. So.
Well, Peter, when do I get to make a pitch for Earth Matters?
Okay.
1:30 Eastern Time Sunday.
Okay. I expect similar pitch for the Environment Show. We're all over the country. Let me ask you both something, though. We've talked about advertisers, and I'm glad to say the Environment Show is sponsored by foundations, which give us the money, so we don't run into that conflict. And I'm also informed by Jim, you reminded me that you were an editor in New York State when I was battling with PCBs and General Electric when I was Environmental Conservation Commissioner 20 years ago now. Has it been your experience or both of your experiences that the silent hand of the advertiser really plays a strong role in the coverage that the country is getting on environmental issues?
Well, I guess I would, this is Jim, I would say no. I think it's decisions in newsrooms I've worked at have been made by editors and by reporters, and I have not seen publishers coming in and saying, let's stop running those stories. They're getting our advertisers angry. I'm lucky that I've worked at some very good newspapers in Louisville, Kentucky, and Philadelphia, both which didn't allow that kind of pressure. But I do think there can be some subtle pressures sometimes. For example, if you were writing, if you were a journalist in Michigan and you wanted to write about the environmental impact of the auto industry, I mean, the auto industry is a major advertiser in this state, and I think there could be some subtle pressures not to offend advertisers.
Peter Dykstra, from the television perspective, GE's ownership of NBC, has that got an impact?
GE's ownership of NBC doesn't have any impact on CNN. I can't.
No, I was thinking about NBC.
There certainly have been some allegations on those lines, and I'd leave it to others to accuse and NBC to defend itself. I know here, I'll say in defense of my own bosses, I have no idea what goes on behind the scenes. Is there any kind of subtle pressure? I couldn't tell you that. I know for a fact that we have in the past reported on stories involving sponsors and literally chased millions of dollars of sponsorship away, and I didn't hear anything about it, suffered no consequence, and obviously I'm still on the job. So I have to assume that that's not a factor and that we can proceed with at least a reasonable confidence. But the confluence of all the things Jim mentioned before, fear of litigation, our own editors, a lack of full understanding of these issues, making them a little bit more tenuous about it. Maybe there's some advertising concerns there. There is a tremendous, as we all know, a tremendous effort to cloud issues of near scientific certainty. We're pretty certain that we have a problem with global warming, and yet there's a lobby out there with some fairly clear ties to industry.
Well, that's
hoping to tell us that there isn't.
That's another question that I think both of you could help us with. The notion which we go over backward, particularly in the media, to give both sides of an issue means that people who may be in the minority of the minority perhaps get more time than they're entitled to. The standard joke is the Flat Earth Society gets time every time, hypothetically, you talk about the round Earth. This has been true of global warming, where the scientific evidence is something like 9-1 or scientists. How do we deal with that issue, being both fair but not giving the minority of the minority equal time?
I think you need to train journalists. These stories are different. There has been a tradition in American journalism in the last half century of what I call sort of a political style of reporting. That is, you report what the Republicans say and then the Democrats. Or on environmental stories, you report what the environmentalists say and then what the business interests say. In fact, these stories are much more complicated. They're much grayer. There's many more shades of meaning. So part of this is we need to train journalists that these are not just conflict stories and that they're complicated stories and the traditional models are not working so well.
There
are critics out there, Peter, who are, to use global warming again, who are credentialed scientists who may also have the serious appearance of conflict. One individual comes to mind who's frequently quoted dismissing concerns about global warming, who's known to be funded by the coal industry. I've got no problem with putting such an individual on the air, but absolutely positively we would make clear that there's a potential for conflict, and we let our viewers and listeners make up their minds.
Okay, well, I want to thank you both for joining us. My guests have been Peter Dykstra, who is executive producer of Science and Technology and Environment for CNN, and Jim Detchen, who is director of the Knight Center of Environmental Journalism at the Michigan State University. We have been talking green. We're interested in your views that you may have on this issue. Give us a call. The phone number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Again, we've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. If you go to our website, you can fill out a questionnaire and tell us all about what you think about the environment and hear the Environment Show at the same time. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We thought we'd take a few moments to update you on a few important stories we've reported. Topping our list is the Headwaters deal, which was finalized in recent weeks. Some $480 million of state and federal monies were used to purchase about 10,000 acres of old-growth forest areas in Northern California. In exchange, the former owner of the property, Pacific Lumber, will be allowed to continue harvesting some 200,000 acres. While many environmentalists applaud the deal that took years of negotiations, others criticize it, saying the government paid too much for the land. We recently reported on the gradual closing of the Freshkill landfill in Staten Island in New York and how thousands of tons of garbage were being shipped to Virginia and other states. In an effort to slow the influx of trash, Virginia legislators have passed a bill that strengthens inspections, caps landfills, and outlaws garbage barges. And finally, the shuffling of large tracts of land continues in the state of Maine. Thousands of acres of the North Woods will be potentially saved from development in what's being called the largest conservation easement in U.S. history. The Pingree family, one of Maine's largest landowners, has granted the New England Forestry Association the option of purchasing an easement on more than 750,000 acres. We'll give you more updates in the future. And now it's time to hear what some of our listeners are saying. Here's Stephen Weska.
In our last airing of the comment line, we read statements emailed to us by a listener who believes immigration is the biggest environmental threat to the United States. Jed from New York City called to say that he disagrees.
Aside from being chauvinistic and jingoistic, he failed to take into consideration that the environment is around the world, not just in this country. And if the people don't come here and destroy it, they're going to go somewhere else and where they live and destroy it. So even though population problem is a major problem, the comments about limiting immigrants is absurd.
A listener named Sam answered the interactive questionnaire on our website to say that he believes pavement runoff, nitrous oxide, and ozone emissions are some of the most important issues facing urban environments. Sam says there should be a shift in funding from highways to public transit and believes making bikeways could also reduce automobile congestion and pollution. Most of the calls we received recently were in response to our discussion on humane slaughter at animal slaughterhouses. Several callers commended us for just covering the topic. Here's a sample of what listeners had to say.
I think the American public is shocked when they hear these details. I think the American public doesn't want this to be going on. And if they were to know, if they really find out what's going on in these slaughterhouses and on these factory farms, they will want something done.
Hi, this is Anonymous from Massachusetts. I totally agree with the fact that some of the USDA officials are powerless or think they're powerless to shut down plants. They don't always see everything, and sometimes they do so not by choice, by choice rather. And I just totally agree with that statement that lady made about the mishandling of chickens and stuff.
We appreciate all comments, questions, suggestions, and story ideas. You can reach our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Hello, operator, I want you to be mine. Please deposit all your love and put me on the line. I'm Mr.
Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. When you're zipping around the icebergs in your Zodiac off Antarctica, and the sea starts to boil beneath you because the nuclear plant at Three Mile Island is melted down again, this program will tell you why it couldn't happen. Call 1-800-323-9262 and order show number 481. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer. Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for The Environment Show.